tonight on Arena. Gavin Friday on his brand new album, Ecce Homo. And we talk to poets Thomas McCarthy and Ahmed Massoud. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Cort International Festival of Literature is 40 this year and it's celebrating with a lineup led by Irish novelists Sally Rooney and Roddy Doyle and the poet Paul Muldoon. The international element is equally central to the popular Galway Festival and they're bringing back the much-loved Cort Lecture next month with Palestinian writer Ahmed Massoud talking about the literature of his homeland. And I'm delighted that Ahmed Massoud joins me now on the line from London. Ahmed, you're very welcome on Arena.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and thank you so much for having me.
Now, you live in Britain, but Gaza is very much front and centre in your fiction and in your plays. You talk about making a conscious decision, I think, to write about the people and that place where you were born and brought up. What's the thinking behind that choice of subject matter?
Well, I wanted to write about Gaza and about my people to present them to the world like any other human beings, basically, because we're often associated with violence and with trouble. We're often referred to as terrorists, unfortunately, which is simply not true. I come from a place that is full of culture, vibrant with civilization, a place where we have the most PhDs per capita in the world, an educated population throughout history.
Sorry, there was just a pause on the line, Ahmed, but we have you now, so please continue to talk.
Yeah, I was saying that we're often referred to as barbarians or more recently human animals. So I wanted to write about Gaza as a normal place like any other place in the world where we have the good and the bad, the heroes and anti-heroes. And that's where my work sort of centers. I've written other stuff, of course, that is not based in Gaza. I wrote stuff about Syria and Afghanistan and other sort of important subjects to the world. But for me, I feel that I have almost like a mission to tell people about my country and my family and my people and the stories behind them, because there are so many amazing stories that people should know about.
Now, I know it's important for you to recall Gaza before the current war, and you describe Gaza as a beautiful Mediterranean city, a bit like Naples, I think you said. Can you paint a picture for us of the Gaza that you remember?
It is indeed like Naples. It's a beautiful place with lots of little alleys, with cafes, restaurants, shops, amazing food, incredible food, something that you haven't experienced before, where it's influenced by Asia and Africa, because Gaza itself is a crossroad between the two continents, of course. We've got that heritage of Middle Eastern food. It's very spicy. We eat a lot of chili for some reason. That's maybe why we have a bit of a fiery spirit in there, but it's incredible. We have amazing restaurants, almost like 5-star restaurants in there, or I should say that we had those restaurants, because unfortunately all of them have been destroyed and Israel has purposely been targeting all of those places that represent life. I have a favorite cafe in Gaza on the beach where I sit and write and meet a lot of my other fellow writers in Gaza and Palestine. But all of that is gone, unfortunately.
Yes, I think, you write about, I think I heard you talking about a trip that you often make, I think, when you're going to Gaza, going from Cairo through the desert and then seeing Gaza in the distance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it usually before this war, and it has been like this for a long time, it takes me about 3 to 5 days to get to Gaza from Cairo. The reason being is that we don't have an airport. We've never had, well, we had an airport once that was destroyed by Israel in the year 2001. And since then, we can only travel through to Cairo, and then we take a bus ride or a taxi, and we're often deported from Cairo airport all the way to Gaza. So we're not allowed to enter into Egypt. And in there, you get stuck on checkpoints because they close by 6 o'clock, Egyptian army checkpoints, and we have to drive all the way to the border. And all through this drive, you're going through deserts and sand dunes and nothing really. And as you get closer to Gaza, you can actually see it in the distance, a beautiful oasis, a green land in there that sort of stands out. And you look, and the first thing you see is Rafah in the south. And it's very green and lots of palm trees, etc. And you get to the border and the Egyptian side is really chaotic. And then you get to the Palestinian side and it's really organized and it's clean and there's air conditioning and they give you a bottle of water and everything. And it's just sort of that homecoming that actually feels so amazing after such a long journey. For me, it's always been difficult to take that journey, especially when I go with my kids on my own, to take two kids. And often they get sick on the way because we sleep on the road, we sleep in cafes. And we sleep on checkpoints most of the time, and it's very dirty and not very hygienic. But then the moment you get there, you get that sense of relief of homecoming, knowing that you are in a place that's so special.
Yes, and I know it's nothing like that now, but it is very nice even to give us this imaginative trip from the past. Ahmed, you were born in Jabalia refugee camp, which was one of the first refugee camps, I think, to be set up once the Israeli state was created. What was it like growing up in a camp like that? I know your father was an intellectual. So were there books? Was there culture? Is it a very rich place in terms of culture, even though the idea of a refugee camp would suggest you would be under an awful lot of pressure?
Yes, there were lots of books. I grew up reading Marx and Lenin and all of the major intellectuals. My dad was a big Marxist at some point, and then he sort of stopped that. But he had all the books. I had literature. I had poetry books by our famous poet Mahmoud Darwish. I read the novels of the Palestinian writer Ghassan Kanafani by the age of 12. I read all of his works. So my dad has always bought books and brought them to the house. The camp was very, very difficult. I mean, my memories of them, of those days, sometimes reminiscent, of course, because it's childhood. When you grow up in a place, and even though it's difficult and it's hard, it becomes home and you build memories there. And the memories I have is the sense of community and the sense of togetherness, that people came together and supported each other and offered whatever little they had with them. But overall, it was really, really difficult. I remember how cold I was. And also, I was speaking to somebody recently about this experience of living in the camp. And we were talking about that in the camp, you have no choice. Every single choice is given to you, including the books that you read, including the clothes that you wear. And somehow, like, the entire experience is cold because you're constantly cold. There's no heating. There's no, like, sewage system. There is no, the walls are very thin. So we grew up in a house that was built of just basically brick walls and then asbestos sheets to cover it. So it was really, really cold in winter and then incredibly hot in summer. So I spent most of my childhood actually outside of the house rather than in the house. I grew up on the street. I used to study, like, finish school and then study outside, take my books outside, because in summer it would be very, very hot, or in winter it's actually colder inside than outside. I started working at the age of 9 because I had to support my family. I used to go to the market, finish school and go to the market and work there. So I think now reflecting on it and now looking at sort of people around me and I'm now having my own kids, and I just think, like, I missed a big chunk of my childhood there. But now also compare it to my nephews and nieces who are currently in Gaza, and he was suffering enormously because they can't even get food now. They can't even find it. My brother can't even find food for them. Just, can you imagine that? And I picture myself there as a child with all the difficulties that I experienced. I still can't picture where they are right now.
Now, you've been living in the UK since 2002, but you have, as you said, a family in Gaza. And then tragically, your brother Khalid was killed in January of 2024. Can you tell us what happened to him?
Yes, so he was out buying bread for the family, or trying to buy some bread. There was nothing in the camp. There were no aids, nothing kind of got in. So he was trying to find some food for his family. And as he went out, the Israeli tanks advanced. We lost touch with him. For 3 days, we didn't know what was happening to him. Nobody could reach him. Nobody could find out at all. And then on the third day, when we heard that the tanks have withdrawn a little bit, his kids went out to look for him, and my cousin as well. And they found him on the street, unfortunately, still bleeding, still alive. He was hit by a drone bomb, and his leg was cut off, and he was still bleeding. So they picked him up, and there was no ambulance or anything. They put him on a donkey cart, and they started, you know, going as fast as possible to get somewhere for help. But unfortunately, he lost his life, or he was killed while he was on the donkey cart with his kids.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for your loss. I know you've written a beautiful poem recalling your brother, and I think it's okay for you to read it for us. Is it, Amir?
It is, yeah, but yes. I'm sorry. I do get quite emotional because he was my my brother and friend and stuff. So I'm going to try. But often when I read this poem, I find it very difficult to complete. So,
well, that's okay. See what you can do. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. So this poem is called To Khalid, my brother. He was killed on the 22nd of January, 2024. Khalid. Eternal is your name, so stay mortal. Beyond the borderlines of this world, beyond the pain, beyond what you have seen in Gaza, beyond your child's. Sorry, it's just difficult. I'll try again. Apologies. I'm going to try again.
You really don't have to read it. It's not necessary. We can actually put it up on our website, and people will be able to access it there. Maybe that might be a good idea. What do you think,
okay. Yeah.
Ahmed?
Yeah,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So, Ahmed, you're coming to the Court Festival, and you're going to be talking about the literature of Palestine. And what writers will you be talking about?
Lots of them. So I want to talk about the idea of the literature of Sumud, which means resilience in Arabic. So what I'm trying to present is how Palestinian literature has actually helped Palestinians and people to cope with the ongoing struggle for the over 76 years of Israelism in Palestine. Darwish, for example, a novelist like Hassan Kanafani, he was killed for his own writing and his own novels back in 1971, and how all of their work has actually enabled us to cope with what is going on. Because what happens with books and literature is that they really record that slow violence that is practiced on people. So what I've just tried to achieve in reading or writing a poem about my brother is really about my brother, but it's also about that pain of the loss that you will never see in a newsreel or on numbers or stats, especially for us Palestinians, because we're not allowed to, especially on media, especially on British media, especially on the BBC and the CNN and all of the others, who don't allow us to be human. So books, literature, poetry allow us to be human. And I want to talk about how Palestinian literature and writers have taken on that role of being the therapists almost and the psychologists of Palestinians in general. For me, I've become a poet since the genocide started. So when the Israeli genocide started, and actually my poem to my brother was the first poem I wrote. I'm a novelist and a playwright. I never wrote poetry. I love poetry, but I find it difficult to write, or I found it difficult to write. But somehow it's allowing me to cope now. It's allowing me to process my emotions and my pain, even though, I'm sorry, I can't read it.
But, that's not quite all right. But I know you are a big, you're both a fan and you have studied Seamus Heaney, and you do see the connection between some of the writers you've talked about and Seamus Heaney.
Absolutely. I did my PhD research on Seamus Heaney and Mahmoud Darwish, and a comparative study between both and their poetry and their sense of cultural identity, and how that has influenced a lot of their work and their writing, and how they've become, out of choice or not, almost like resistance fighters themselves, you know, with their words and with their literature. And with Gaza, a lot of writers have been really sort of influential in also fighting occupation with their pen rather than anything else, and with their words and with their beautiful poetry and beautiful literature as well. But the lecture is also going to highlight the place of Gaza and Palestine as like a beacon and as a hub for literary production, which is and is something not very well known about Palestine in general. We have, as I said, the most PhDs per capita in the world. We are a very educated population, and we have amazing writers and poets who've been like in the forefront of the entire literary movement in the Arab world in the 20th century and the 21st century. As well, we have Imam Shafi'i. He was one of the main major sort of imams or sheikhs in Islam. He explained Islam to people, and he was a poet and a philosopher. He's very well known, and he comes from Gaza as well. So I want to kind of take people on a journey through this lecture in terms of going back in history a little bit. Where is Gaza? Where was Gaza before 100 years ago, 200 years ago? Not geographically, but its place amongst that region and its importance as well. And where are we now? And maybe just go in the future a bit, and what's going to happen later on, I suppose.
Well, Ahmed Massoud, thank you so much for talking to us this evening. And we're looking forward to you coming to Court to give your lecture on the literature of resistance, or SUMUD, on Saturday, the 12th of April at the Town Hall Theatre, Galway. Further details from court.ie. Gavin Friday has never been one to follow convention. As a founding member of the Virgin Prunes, he helped redefine what Irish music could be: raw, theatrical and unapologetically avant-garde. Since then, his solo career has just been as unpredictable, blending cabaret, electronica and art rock. Now, after a 13-year hiatus, he returns with Echo Homo, a deeply personal album that reflects on love, loss, the enduring friendships that shaped him, and why even after decades in music he still refuses to play it safe. Ahead of his much anticipated Irish shows, I'm delighted to be joined by Gavin Friday in studio. Much anticipated, you've done two already.
Yes, we just came back from Portugal. We played Porto and the beautiful city of Lisbon. Yeah.
Oh, right. And how did they go?
Really well, especially the Lisbon show. First show is a little rocky, as they always are. But second show is wonderful. Yeah.
Right. And you're then digging into two shows here in Ireland.
Later.
So Echo Homo, which was released at the end of 2024, it's the first album in 13 years. So what inspired you to write and produce a record after 13 years?
Well, I started it a little earlier than 13 years, and I sort of spin many plates at the same time. So I started working on some of the songs maybe 12 years ago, but I didn't know I was working towards the album, and I put the songs on the shelf. And eventually the reason why the 13 years happens was, well, I did plan to go out and make a new album after the last album, Catholic, but stuff comes in around the corner. Work with Shakespeare Theatre went off, the soundtrack stuff. And then my own mother got quite ill, and I took time off to look after her. But really, it was around 2018 when I took all the music I'd been working on, and I decided, yes, this looks like it could be an album, and started finishing it.
Shall we listen to the Ecce Homo, which is the title track?
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it then after
Absolutely.
We hear it.
Absolutely, why not? Yeah.
Ecce Homo there, the title track of Gavin Friday's new album, and he is currently on tour and he's doing two gigs in Dublin, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So we're back in Catholic iconography there. We have the crucifixion, we've the words of Pontius Pilate, which is Ecce Homo, which means behold the man.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you're playing with that. You're being subversive in some way.
I am indeed. It's not really irreligious or about the Catholic thing. It's more a kick against far right fundamentalism, especially, you know, when I was writing this, I said 2018, 2019, I really started finishing the album. And a certain man was the President of the United States of America, and he is back being the President of America. And I'd never felt as riled up and as angry as when I was a young punk in the Virgin Prunes, when I was kicking against the then Catholic Church and the Thatcher-Reaganite world we were dealing with. And I just see the rise and rise of this belligerence against where the world has come to in the last 50 years, the rights of women being threatened, the rights of trans and gay sexuality, the rights of migrants, just the rights of anybody that's bloody free. So it's a protest song about far-right fundamentalism. And
challenging, I guess, the notion of behold the man. What does a man mean?
Correct. And challenging everyone's rights. It's only the beginning of a Trump second reign, let's call it. And my God, it's quite frightening.
Now, the album also looks back at your enduring friendships, the ones of your childhood, Bono and Googie. And there's a wonderful song called When the World Was Young.
Yeah,
tell us a little bit about that. We'll play some of it too. Gavin.
Well, it's something happens when you get into your 60s, especially if you lose some friends or a parent. And I've lost both parents in the last while and some close friends during the COVID situation. So it's sort of normal to actually reflect back. And in an optimistic way, I've seen also the way things have changed in Ireland, which I'm very happy about. But I looked back at the young Gavin Friday and the young Bono and Googie in this song, and it's really just looking at there's so many obstacles against young people creating. Mm-hmm. And they were all there when we were 15 and 16 forming bands. We were told there was no future, and we just jumped for it and went for our
And dreams. You were lucky to find each other, three such creative people.
Yeah, I don't think we knew at the time. I put it down in retrospective. You understand things a bit better when you get older. we had, the three of us had dysfunctional relationships with our dads. So I think that was a common bond. And we felt connected through music and art, which sounds sort of pretentious on one level when you're 15, but it meant everything to us. And we just went for our dreams and didn't listen to anybody.
Okay, let's listen to When the World Was Young.
When the world was young and time was too, all troubled me meant the best for you.
That's When the World Was Young, Gavin Friday there, and it's from his new album, Ecce Homo. Gavin, you talked about your mother there and Hanvi's story and that she passed away in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great support to you when you were that young punk.
Yeah, yeah.
And that arty creative boy. She really helped you and was a support to that creativity.
Yeah, yeah. Beyond the support, I was the eldest, and the clash of the father and the son, the typical old story of Ireland, and she was in the middle of us, but she was totally supportive. She was the seamstress to the Virgin Prunes. She made our clothes. She was a dressmaker by trade. But she came from that sort of era where she was actually highly educated in her brain, but not literal. And I actually believe she was more artistic than she even knew. And she just had this undying support for me, no matter what I said.
And she loved music as well, didn't she? She loved like the Goths. She loved Susie and the Banshees, all those kind of, not to mind doing the fairly risque outfits that the Virgin Prunes would be wearing.
Yeah, but I think that was just a mother's love. She'd be watching Top of the Pops in 1981 and she'd be seeing all these bands and, you know, she'd be falling in love with David Bowie and Susie and the Banshees simply because I was probably falling in love with them. It was just true mother's love.
Now you have a song on the album about her, and it's about a flower.
Yeah, the song is called Amaranthus, and she grew. Well, Amaranthus is this gorgeous red plant. It looks like sort of a floral version of a small weeping willow. And it means love lies bleeding. And she grew them in her back garden. But my mum got Alzheimer's. And for me, it was a perfect analogy because over the 6-7 years it took her to die, it's like it's a slow death, losing the spirit and the soul of your loved one. And there's a little bit of punky anger there and a little bit of Susie and the Banshees for her. But it's a frustrating thing, and a lot of people get a little flowery about Alzheimer's, but I didn't find it pleasant at all. And needed it. It's a very difficult situation for anyone to deal with.
Now, at the end of Amaranthus, you have a tape of her from the last voice message she left you. And of course, Gavin Friday isn't the name you were born with.
No.
You were born with Fionnán Hanvey.
Yes.
So you'll hear her. We'll just play a little clip from Amaranthus where she leaves you a lovely message. A wonderful tribute to your mum there. And that was, of course, a song she loved, Daisy Daisy, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I sang it at her funeral, but it was her favourite song.
Now, the Virgin Prunes were always pushing boundaries, both in what you sang and how you dressed and how you presented yourselves and how challenging you were. Do you feel then in Ecce Homo you are again pushing the boundaries?
I don't know about that. I mean, sonically and musically, it's electronic with a lot of classical instruments. I've made much more artistic and aesthetically challenging music, I would say. But it's pushing the boundaries maybe in emotions. I tend to sing about the loves that don't speak their name, and that isn't just about sexuality. Even in Stations of the Cross, it's once again, there's a religious imagery, but it's about the worst torture and the worst crucifixion is when a couple knows a relationship is over, but they keep going round and round that loop. And it's just the sort of the ugly sores that people don't really talk about. So I tend to push that boundary in all areas I go. Yeah.
And then there's a track called The Church of Love. So that's very much an open embrace to love of all forms.
It is. And it's a celebration of love of all forms and all gender fluidity. And not even just gender fluidity, just love for the sake of love. And it's a big celebration. And you know, the change I've seen in this country where people like the young Gavin Fridays are now being embraced and not questioned, but they're being loved for who they are. So, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And you are yourself happy in a 20-year-old relationship, is that right?
I am, yeah. Very happy.
Yeah, with Patrick.
With Patrick and a little dog called Stan, believe it or not.
So you've a nice little family.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to The Church of Love.
Shame, shame, shame. We know no shame. We're all alone.
That was The Church of Love from Gavin Friday there from Echo Homo, his new album. That'll have them bopping in the Spirit Store in Dundalk and Vicar Street in Dublin, Gavin.
Yeah, they're coming up in April.
That's right, April the 8th, you're in the Spirit Store in Dundalk, and the 10th then in Vicar Street in Dublin. And there you're talking about giving people permission, I guess, guys as well as women, to wear the dress.
Absolutely. And say to pray in our own way. No Pope, no Rome. So there's still a bit of virgin prune in me. Yeah, I'm still
kicking.
I
never thought it had gone anywhere. Once a punk, always a punk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Though it's very rocky, I think. I think you're going to have people bopping.
It's I wrote it with a guy called Dave Ball, who's from Soft Cell back in the 80s. And it's inspired by Wigan dancing, so Northern Soul meets electro pop. Yes,
you do get that vibe off it.
Yeah.
And so, is it going to be lots of bopping at the gigs, or sit down and behave and listen?
Well, you don't sit down at Spirit Store; it's all standing, and it's a small sort of punky acoustic club. Well, even though we're not playing acoustically, Vicar Street. I am having seats because for an hour and a half, 2 hour show, I'm at the age where I like sitting.
Oh, yeah. People can get on there.
If you want to dance, stand up. Yeah, no problem.
Well, let's listen to one last track. This is The Best Boys in Dublin. What can you tell us about that, Gavin?
Well, I mentioned my dog, Stan, and he had a brother who passed away about a year and a half ago, Ralph. And Stan is nearly 15, but the two dogs go everywhere with me in Dublin, and they were in all the recording sessions, and I'd written this little song, but when Ralph passed was when I was mixing the album. So to celebrate the great love those little furry creatures give us, I added strings and mixed
what
this.
What kind of a dog was Ralph?
They're both long-haired Dachshunds, so sausage dogs.
Oh, very nice, very nice. People will recognise, well, Stan, if they see him with you.
You usually don't see me in Dublin without him. So, yeah.
Okay, let's listen to The Best Boys in Dublin. The Best Boys in Dublin there from Gavin Friday. My thanks to Gavin Friday. Thank you so much for coming on Arena. You can see Gavin on the 8th of April in the Spirit Store in Dundalk and on the 10th of April in Vicar Street in Dublin. Full details on gavinfriday.com. We turn now to a new poetry collection by Thomas McCarthy. Heritage, gardens, memory and an abundance of themes are all explored in Plenitude. This latest collection by the Waterford-born poet follows previous releases, Pandemonium and Prophecy. Plenitude is published by Carcanet Press, and I'm delighted to be joined from our Cork studio by Thomas McCarthy. You're so welcome, Thomas.
Thank you, Kay.
So we had Pandemonium, Prophecy and now Plenitude. You'd know you were a poet. Even the titles resonate.
Well, my earlier books were I felt two titles that were too long, so I decided to have a few books that would be as brief as possible, which is one word. Actually, can I just say how much I loved your talking with Ahmed Massoud just a minute ago? It was one of the most incredible interviews I've ever listened to. I mean, what misfortune and suffering that poet has to go through is incredible. And to think of his brother Khalid dying, just bleeding to death on the street, and his remembrance of Mahmoud Darwish. One of the last things I got from Dennis O'Driscoll, the poet, before he died, was a collection of Mahmoud Darwish's poems. And Dennis said, you must get to know this work and you must get to know the poets of Palestine. So it was so incredible to listen to Ahmed Massoud, you know, particularly as a poet. I suppose I know that we have the great privilege now of working with slightly cooler metals when we're making poetry, whereas they have to work with very hot metal as part of a kind of a national duty to their own people, you know. And that sort of duty has faded away for Irish poets, thanks be to God. We merely can have our own personal lives now.
Can you see why he might have made the choice to go and embrace poetry now, after being a playwright and a novelist in these times of such hardship for himself and his family?
I think it's a journey into intensity, to be honest with you. I think that poetry is possibly the most intense music you can have. I'm just thinking there of Gavin Friday as well, and his kind of memories of his mother and his dog Ralph and Stan, and how like they are all part of the Church of Love, you know, which is the opposite of the Church of Suffering, which is the politics of this world, you know. And poets, I think, belong to, like, they do belong to another, I don't know, dimension in terms of the spiritual content of what they make. But sometimes there are urgent national necessities, and poets do step up when they're called to speak as well, you know, which is, I always admire that, you know.
Your poem is full of intensity as well, and a lot of the poems are about things that grow and gardens, and sometimes they're a metaphor and sometimes they're a real thing that brings people together.
That's true. I think a garden is a fantastic metaphor because it is both a natural thing and it's a thing that is nature arranged. And I think that is almost a metaphor for the poetic act itself, you know.
You're going to begin, you're going to read a few poems for us. Mm. And I was going to ask you to read A Meadow in July, if you wouldn't mind starting with that, Thomas.
Okay. A Meadow in July. It's just that a poem is forming a meadow for itself and then a window. Not a modern window at all, but an old flaking casement thing, ropes and pulleys and weights you could hear banging inside their unpainted timber frames. The deepest thing has a rumble that you can never see, a distant thunder in a thundery July. The way poems heave in their nervousness before small birds hit the windows, thinking poetry is a drift of insects or some such promise of food. We gaze beyond our rooms in idleness, idly dreaming of things outside ourselves, a full plate that we intuit before we come to our senses in that hideout the poem has made between our faces and July. See, it's the same poem has placed glass between us and a meadow.
That's A Meadow in July from Plenitude by Thomas McCarthy. There, that line, the way poems heave in their nervousness, is that on their way to fruition or in their reading?
I think it's in the making. I was thinking of how poems get made, you know. When I started writing poetry first, I was kind of obsessed with form and formality and verse structure and things like that. Now I can see that that's not what poetry is at all, that in fact poetry is an assembly of emotional tones correctly arranged. And I think that's the best and deepest kind of poetry, I think.
As I said, gardens are all over the book, and we'll talk about one or two of them in a moment. But you've been a gardener all your life. In fact, I think that's how you met the writer Molly Keane, who you have a poem dedicated to called Smoke in this. That love of, was it a love of gardening, or were you, was it just a job you started out with and grew to love it?
I grew to love it. But I mean, I knew about gardening and gardens and taking cuttings because my grandmother, who was actually blind, had a terrific collection of pelargoniums and geraniums. And I was the only one she trusted to kind of look after them, to water them and to make sure. And she taught me about, you know, because she was blind, she would go through all of them in the yard outside the back door, and she would press her finger into each, into the soil, and she'd say, that needs watering, that needs watering, that needs watering. And so it was a kind of a plenitude of caring for things that live and want to live and flower. I think that stayed with me. And then I began gardening for an elderly Anglo-Irish person, Dennis Fitzgerald, who was the grandson of the Duke of Leinster, who had bought a house and was rebuilding really a Victorian garden near where my house was. And so I got to know Molly. She used to come and for cocktail parties at that house. And because I was writing poetry and they were being published in school magazines, I was indulged, I think. They used to come where I was working, and I'd be chatting to Molly about flowers and various things.
All right, and you did grow to have a very good friendship with her.
Oh, very, very good. She was just a most fabulous, wicked person. I mean, she was, you know, she loved gossip and she loved being sharp, really. But she was just the most fantastic, imaginative person you could ever believe. Now, I have a long poem called I have a long poem in the book about Molly, Smoke, yeah. Mm. And it's based really on a whole set of images from her, from about 14 of her novels, which are, each one of her novels is unique, and each one is just brilliant, you know.
I also read an essay you wrote about her and Elizabeth Bowen and their friendship, where they both seemed to be quite terrified of each other, which was very good.
They were really, because Molly was terrified because Elizabeth had moved to Oxford and was with her husband there, and she seemed to be highly educated to Molly, and Elizabeth was terrified of Molly's fierceness, the things she might come out with. She was absolutely terrified of her too. But they were incredible friends. I mean, the last time they were together was when Elizabeth was having chemotherapy, and I remember there's a photograph of them somewhere which I'd seen, and they were actually shopping for wigs for Elizabeth for her chemotherapy. You know, they were made a day out of that. Everything was to be celebrated, you know.
Now, I'd love if you would read A Lover of Rare Apple Varieties. This is a love poem. This is a love poem to your wife. And there are so many wonderful poems about gardening and about your wife, Catherine. There's one called The White Album, where you talk about plants as if there were, you know, much loved tracks from an album.
Yeah.
You might read.
Okay, A Lover of Rare Apple Varieties. And she is a lover of rare apple varieties. The poem is kind of about the vanity of being an old man, I suppose. Only recently I discovered that I was the lover of a lover of rare apple varieties. It was a thing she'd kept hidden for years. Sometimes the scent was everywhere after a night of love, fresh linen scented with the unbidden feel of apple blossom, unbidden by me, but recovered by her in the way she twisted as if bedclothes were an orchard in May. Love has that quality, a spring-like blossom, and in its great hatred of frost, its yearning for the sun's rays and the quickening of days. Now I follow her as she roams from heritage sapling to heritage sapling, my pace slower but still firm, the air lightened by all the names she stores beneath the lattice of her hair and in the small diary she kept hidden under her pillow. In my innocence, I thought she was keeping a journal about me. What fools men are, old poets especially. Now I can plainly see she was noting the moods of trees, all their compliance with feeding guides, the annual refinement of RHS rules. She noted her years of triumph, their prize-winning years, misfortunes of intruding deer, thefts of expensive earthenware, but nothing about my work. When the first frosts lay bare the limitations of tender bark, when clippings of newspaper reviews collapsed into a green mould, it will become clear that my life has been given over to this lover of varieties, a keeper of Gibson's russet, Ballinora Pippin. Such trees.
Fantastic. That's a beautiful poem. Thomas, would we have time for you to read The Great War? Because it's a wonderful poem about really talking about you being the last generation who has a link to that momentous time.
Yeah. When I was a child, I remembered some elderly men in my hometown and indeed in the towns nearby who had survived the Somme, came home in shell shock and were suffering from really what we now know as post-traumatic stress, you know. Anyway, the Great War. We've almost come to the edge of remembering. When I am gone, the precipice begins, beyond which no ear will hear the repeated warnings of an elderly guardsman shell-shocked at the Somme, but standing guard in old age outside the officer's map room of Fraher's shop, warning me to take cover among the late bundles of the Irish Press and the Daily Mail. Such anxieties will be inaccessible and the churning of mud will be over. Similarly, my memories will make way for the brief enfilade of gossip, the nighttime intrusion, the sudden alarm of an approaching celebrity columnist. Fresh rivers of blood will have a new name. Shoulders will heave again against the dead weight of the moment. A comment may kill us as wars once did. The other war vanishes in a recessional of named roses, becomes remembrance merely, receding into vermilion hybrids and memory books of breeders' names. A young man passes by talking into his sleeve, conversing with the ether in the way the wounded did. It is a nightmare, this renewal, a tank screeching into reverse, a horse backing away.
The Great War there, read by Thomas McCarthy from Plenitude, his new collection, which is published by Carcanet Poetry. Thomas, it's a joy as ever to talk to you.
Thank you.
That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields and Simon O'Gallagher researched. Mark McGraw was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Shannon Gorman. John Creedon is next.